Welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie, and I might give you the Heimlich maneuver next time you do that.
I wouldn't mind. Let's get weird. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. I am, as you know, and some of the people who follow us on Twitter know, I am currently in Southern California, in San Diego, and it is beautiful, and it is sunny. That is true. But there's something I want to talk to you about. Are you familiar with the town of Carlsbad?
No, I've only heard of Carlsbad Caverns.
I don't know where that is. Where's that? Is that
like
the same place?
New Mexico.
Okay. This is not that place. This is like a beach town. It's a little bit north of San Diego. Mm-hmm. It's like where Legoland is.
Okay.
I don't know much about it. Maybe our listeners will have a better sense of the demographic, but the sense I've gotten from people who've talked about this is that it's sort of got an Orange County kind of feel. A little bit sort of right-leaning, a little bit maybe
rich.
MAGA. Rich maybe is my sense too. And the reason I bring it up and the reason I am terribly vexed by Carlsbad and they have become the object of my wrath and ire is I did a day trip there. And I was, there's like a nice long walk along the beach that you can do like a walkway and super crowded, tons of people and there's signs that say masks required, but nobody was wearing masks. I'm like, I did like an informal survey of counting 100 people and I saw like 5 to 7 people wearing masks. And these people are like, they're, a lot of them were older, a lot of them looked like they had comorbidities, a lot of them didn't look like the healthiest specimens and they were all walking around without masks and it enraged me, enraged.
So this walk, this kind of more popular walk you're talking about is obviously outdoors, right?
It's outdoors.
Okay. There's a lot of states in America that do not require masks outside at all. I think California is a bit unique in that. I don't know the numbers, but I do know that a lot of states will be okay if you're outside. And I have to say close quarters, I'm never okay with it, but because I was in Oregon recently and a lot of people weren't wearing masks outside. And I kept putting my mask on every time I got near a person. And, you know, one of my friends was like, you don't need to do that here. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm near a human. I'd rather do it than not.
Yeah.
Like, it's on
I'm
me.
A What's human person dealing with the pandemic. Yeah. I'm going to put on a mask.
Right.
I mean, I get it. If you're in the middle of nowhere and there's no one around, you don't need to have a mask on. But this was a crowded walkway. This is a sidewalk, essentially, that people are walking on. You're walking with people all the time. And it even if it wasn't the thing that you're supposed to do, which it is here in California, and it is there in Carlsbad, even if it wasn't, you should absolutely do it, or at least have a mask with you around your chin in case you need to pull it up or something.
Right.
But there was none of this. There was none of this. I was so mad. But then something really crazy happened. We're like, again, all wearing our masks. This woman comes up to me and she has a phone and she's like, not wearing a mask. And she's like, hey, will you take a picture of me?
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I'm not going to touch your phone. Person not wearing a mask. I don't want you even coming that close to me.
Right.
Do not. I don't take your own damn. So can we just agree that in a pandemic, you don't have other people take your phone and take pictures of you? Is that so hard to ask?
Interesting. I've done it.
Oh.
But I've gone up to someone with a mask and say, do you mind taking a photo? You know, if you're not comfortable, I totally get it. You know, I have Purell right here. I just washed my phone. You know what I mean? I'm like, I'll go out of my way to make it okay. And I get it. If someone was like, you know, I'm not comfortable, I'd be like, cool, totally fine. But you have to let them off the hook. You have to be like, why? So what, when you said no and, you know, laughed in her face, was she like disappointed in her angry
or pissed?
She looked
a little surprised. Oh. She looked a little like, oh, and I'm like, oh my God, God.
Yeah.
And then she walked away. I think she recognized that it was kind of like not appropriate.
Yeah.
But because she's in an environment where nobody else is wearing a mask and nobody else seemed to care, she just was making bad decisions. And that's, I mean, like, I'm like, this is what's happening in a crowded area. What's happening in a restaurant, in a bar, you know? Yeah. I mean, we're not through this thing yet.
Yeah.
We're not. We have a long way to go.
Yeah. I mean, numbers are going up. I think I read in 36 states this week. No, it's totally crazy. And yet there are personal risks that people are going to take, you know, and you just have to make calculated risks, right? Like if this is a narrow sidewalk and if I'm walking past anybody in San Francisco, I either cross the street or put my mask on or at least hold something up to my face just out of like, it's
decency.
Just courtesy, right?
Yeah, just courtesy.
I don't actually think I'm going to give them COVID on the street, or I turn my back to them and it feels actually quite rude, but I'll turn my back because guess what? If my back is to your back and we're a foot apart, that's probably 3 or 4 feet away. You know what I mean?
Like,
I know that there are ways to avoid this, and I'm not going to live my life in my house all day, every day. I am going to take calculated risks. And apparently I am going to ask people to take a photo of me with my filthy, filthy phone.
Oh, God,
I apologize
you're
to you.
Dirty, dirty, dirty person. Anyway, Carl's bad. More like Carl's the worst.
Oh, snap.
Anyways, I feel better now. I had a couple of California burritos later. My anger has subsided. And I'm excited right now for our next two guests. We have Dr. Tyler Black and Dr. Emily Deans, two really badass psychiatrists who are going to talk to us about the effects of COVID on mental health directly and indirectly. Before we get to them, as always, please make sure to follow us at Twitter at The House of Pod. You can find us at Facebook and Instagram as well. If you haven't already, please go to iTunes and rate and subscribe there. That does help get new listeners to the show. We really appreciate everything you guys are doing. Thank you to Nadeem for helping us with getting these episodes out. Anyone you want to thank, Lizzie?
No.
Very good. Stay tuned.
To the bar last night, a wealth of drinks to forget the pain, wondering what the world be like, decisions led to set things right, wake up near a string of string lights, passed out on the floor again, thinking how the nation's fallen, pondering is it Saturday, skip the dose of Seroquel.
And welcome back. Today we have two special guests joining us. We have Dr. Emily Deans, instructor at Harvard and an evolutionary psychiatrist, as well as Dr. Tyler Black, a suicidologist. And we are going to talk about some COVID-related mental health topics. Thank you both for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, and thank you for having me too.
Dr. Deans, I will call you Emily going forward, if that's okay with you.
Perfect.
I've never heard the term evolutionary psychiatrist, and I assume most of our guests or most of our listeners have not heard it either. So do you mind explaining or defining or what your interpretation is?
That came from a long time ago where I got really interested in paleo and ancestral health. How I always looked at it was like a hypothesis generating background, like how did we evolve and how did our biology intersect with the modern world and what are problems with the modern world or differences that could possibly cause mental health problems. And so it wasn't ever, you know, it was never a person who wanted to get rid of airplane flights and throw the baby out with the bathwater. But, you know, is it possible that our immune system could be better off if we didn't clean everything all the time? Or is it possible that we could be better off without unnatural light 24/7 and getting up in the middle of the night and looking at our phones at 3 a.m. And what does that do to our eyes and what does that do to our brain?
Right.
And so none of us to say that any of that's wrong, because scientifically you have to say it's a null hypothesis, but a lot of my writing and a lot of my speaking has been about, you know, how do we look at this scientifically and how can we take the best things about our ancestral and evolutionary history and combine them with our modern life to be the healthiest and the happiest that we can be.
Tyler, you're a suicidologist. Can you tell us what that means? I assume it has something to do with suicides.
Yeah, so it's literally someone who studies suicide is a suicidologist. And suicide, you know, it's one of those things, whenever I mention being a suicidologist, people always say, oh, that must be so depressing, or that must, you know, what an awful topic to research. And without question, suicide is fraught with lots of emotions. But, you know, it's not a lot different than researching cancer, which is also horrible, or trauma surgery, which is also always someone's worst moment. And suicide is a major cause of death in America. It ranks usually number 10 or number 11 all time. And in the first decade of life, it's usually one or two, depending on the year. It's a really big deal and tremendously understudied. I can't overstate how much misinformation is in medical textbooks on suicide.
That's really cool. Actually, I never heard of a suicidologist, and I never heard of an evolutionary psychiatrist either. So it's really cool to get you both on. But if you don't mind me asking, where in your studies did you decide to focus on suicidology?
So I was one of my very first rotations as a psychiatry resident. This is after I had selected psychiatry as a specialty. I arrived at a hospital and there had been a suicide. Actually, I discovered the person walking towards the hospital. So I discovered the suicide. So I went in to, report, I'm here for duty. By the way, I want to let you know there's somebody who's passed away. And in the month that followed, I was exposed to all of the institutional, personal, educational responses to a suicide. And to call a suicide in a community like a nuclear bomb is not an understatement. I mean, it has ripple effects that just, really go out there. But I was there as a learner as well. And I got exposed to one preceptor telling me, this one fact about suicide. And another preceptor would say, hey, that thing that you've heard about, the opposite is true. And so I came into this with my general, I'm very much an intellectualizer. I love to read about science. And so I really dove into the science as a first year resident of suicide. And I recognized that almost everything in the literature about suicide was not being taught about suicide. We're being taught how to do risk assessments, even though risk assessment is fraught with bad predictions. We're taught about racial characteristics of suicide, even though the racial representation, for example, of Indigenous Americans for suicide has nothing to do with their race and everything to do with the racism. I would read about phrases to use or overstatements about suicide and certain things, like adolescents are more at risk for suicide, even though there's no group of age in which someone's less at risk for suicide than when they're an adolescent. So, it was just full of so many contradictions when I was reading versus what I was being taught that I knew that this was something I could really step into.
Emily, can you tell us a little bit about what you've studied or found of the effects that COVID has on the human brain, what we've learned over these last 6+ months?
Right. So I think we have to separate this into two frames. I think we have to separate this into what COVID as an infectious entity actually does to the human brain. And then we have to separate it into what does the pandemic and lockdown and the whole process, because that's a whole separate thing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start with, what COVID does to the human brain. And, this is kind of interesting because it's not the first time this has happened. I had linked on my Twitter account a few days ago about a history of pandemics and their psychological effects, the actual psychological effects of being infected. And so in the 1890s, there was what they thought was a flu epidemic, but what some people suspect was the first coronavirus entrance into the human population of OC43, which is a human coronavirus that has now become like a normal cold coronavirus. And after that infection, a number of people had serious psychiatric side effects, including psychosis, brain fog, long-term depression, to the point where, back at the time, hysteria and all those things generally were considered female attributes, but because so many men had been infected, they sort of reversed course and said, oh, no, this is due to your Russian flu that you had. It could have been a flu. It could have been coronavirus. We don't know what it was, but there were tons of neuropsychiatric and extended side effects of this 1890 plague. Fast forward to 1917, 1918, there was a huge outbreak of something called encephalitis lethargica. It's personal to me because my great uncle, who was a teenager at the time, actually had encephalitis lethargica, and he was totally normal kid, and he became institutionalized and died in the next 10 years in an institution no longer functional, with something like what we would call chronic fatigue in times now. And there was a huge outbreak of this with the 1918 flu. We don't know precisely that it was associated with the 1918 flu, but we do know that these pandemic infections and infections in general can cause neuropsychiatric and long-term side effects, including depression, brain fog, and also autonomic dysfunction, what we call POTS syndrome. And we're seeing this now in what we call long COVID. And if you look up long COVID, you'll see it. And the only reason it's, you know, it happens with enteroviruses, it happens with, mononucleosis. Those viruses rarely, occasionally cause these problems, but we're now seeing a huge outbreak of a new set of this because we have a new virus that's hitting everybody all at once. So I find that really interesting, and that inflammation can definitely lead to this depression, the brain fog, and anxiety that we're seeing. Also, just with very ill individuals who are in the ICU for very long periods of time, we're seeing a lot of delirium, which happens with infectious diseases, with surgery, with injuries. And this is something that's very scary and very common in hospitals. And it's another sequela of COVID that we're seeing now in vast amounts.
That sounds really interesting to me. It sounds like there is this historical precedent for this sort of effect. So I take it you're not really surprised by the myriad of psychological symptoms that we're seeing.
I'm not. You know, I'm someone who has always been very interested in the biological and medical and psychological line. And there are some very interesting studies. For example, people who are positive for exposure to flu, like flu A, if they also have bipolar disorder, they have higher rates of suicide and psychosis than people who weren't exposed to flu A. Hmm. There are also other, you know, well-known things like trichinosis and other parasites that affect the brain that cause psychiatric symptoms. There's this theory going on all along that the psychiatric syndrome sort of depression sort of resembles an illness syndrome. So when you are sick with the flu, you want to avoid being with anybody. You want to kind of like hang out in your bed and put your covers over your head. You have a foggy brain. You can't pay attention. And so there's this idea that this inflammation associated with ongoing stress it causes this sort of illness phenotype that is related to depression.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising that an actual illness causes the same phenotype in the frontal lobe and with inflammation.
You would think that if viruses were smart, they would make you feel like you're on crack or meth or cocaine, like, because then you shouldn't want to like curl up in your bed all by yourself, be sad and whatever. Like, you should want to go out and party so the virus can spread and replicate, right? Like, isn't that a great idea?
How come illness doesn't make us happy is what he's asking right now.
This is why humans have survived, right? Because we evolved this capability to hide and hide in a corner when we were sick and not spread it to everybody.
Yeah, I'm just saying, if I get COVID, I want the meth-fueled COVID.
Right.
I don't want the downer.
Yeah, that's
slightly less than meth. Maybe just this.
Right, just a slight upper.
You know what, Tyler? I don't know you that well. I think I want the meth. You don't know. Okay. You don't know me. Just kidding.
It is an interesting thing about like pathology that it's always bad. It's like whenever I was dealing with like a patient when I was doing my psychiatry rotations, and there would always be like the patient that you would talk to as a medical student, and they would tell you about the voices in their head. The voices were always saying awful things. And I was always like, how come the voices don't say nice things? Like, you look nice today. Why don't we go dancing? Let's go dancing.
I mean, have you seen a manic patient? Because they'll tell you that you're the child of God and that.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
One of the coolest studies I read about voices, just to piggyback off that, was a study looking at voices as experienced by people who have schizophrenia in different regions of the world. In America, the voices are almost entirely antagonistic and they're usually critical. In Africa, schizophrenic voices are often quite pleasurable and usually are saying kind or spiritually awakening things. And there's actually cultural differences in how voices will be represented in schizophrenia. So far more common to be persecutorial on the North American continent.
Wow.
On the African continent. Yeah.
That's any thoughts why that might be?
I think, you know, the culture lays down how we experience things, right? So there's always a lens in which we experience phenomenon that we interpret. Thunder, before we know much about meteorology, maybe a voice from God or some kind of supernatural event. And so anytime there's thunder, we interpret it as a deity talking to us. But of course, as we learn about it and our culture, you know, recognizes that there's other reasons for weather, then all of a sudden the thunder is just, oh, it's a thunderstorm. And so our interpretation of a perception will change really quite a lot because of the culture. And there's a lot of thought about the general culture of American sort of persecutory thought. Americans are a little bit more prone to that type of thought.
Yeah. I mean, we're really good at persecuting others, so I'm sure we're pretty hard on ourselves too. I'm just saying. You know, Emily, can you tell our listeners who might not know, I think this concept of the thing that I've been reading the most about COVID, these long haulers and the long-term effects is this concept, and you mentioned it, of brain fog. And I don't know that a lot of people know that. I bet you almost everyone has experienced it, but can you elaborate a little bit on it? And is there any kind of chemical imbalance that has been studied? Because in my mind, it's quite subjective.
That's a tough question, interesting question. In general, your brain fog is going to be where all of a sudden you're going to have to use, sticky notes to keep track of things when you never had to before.
Yeah.
Where you're not remembering conversations that you had with someone that you had before, where you're using a lot more effort to think about things that 2 months ago you could, you know, keep it straight right away.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a couple patients. I'm from Massachusetts. Right now. So we had many, 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 many COVID cases, including my family, actually, I think. And some of my patients did have long-term 2 to 3 month brain fog after their COVID experience. Fortunately, it has resolved. There's all sorts of interesting reasons for that. Is it inflammation in the brain? Certainly, it could be. Certainly, cytokines and IL-6 and IL-2 and all these other things can be higher when they look at these things. There are also studies showing that the microbiome in the gut, if it's off, is associated with brain fog. And if you clear that up with antibiotics or by not taking a probiotic that was causing the problem anymore, that the brain fog goes away. And the brain fog is associated with, for example, eating yogurt a few hours later. I mean, there's all sorts of very interesting connections that we haven't fully, studied at this point.
Yeah. I mean, if anyone's had like surgery, a few hours later, or a procedure like Kaveh and I do colonoscopies with, we use Versed, quote unquote truth serum, midazolam and fentanyl. And honestly, if anyone's pulled an all-nighter or been terribly hungover, that I think that's the closest state to a healthy person who's not had COVID can relate to that. I think everyone can relate to the concept. And it's kind of fascinating because it's so clearly and so descriptive and yet not like that well defined. It's such great terminology.
I've seen great studies of brain fog that have they haven't quantified it at all. They just talked about brain fog, and they might have studied the microbiome and quantified all this and quantified all that, but they never did brain. And you're just like, just do a test, do a screen. I don't know.
Yeah.
But we don't always have that in psychiatry.
Right. Right.
So Tyler, it's been a pretty common talking point for politicians, particularly in the Trump administration, that these people have warned that all these lockdown measures, everything we're doing during this pandemic, it could lead to increasing rates of suicide. And that's been a concern on both sides. So what is the data showing now? And where are we at right now with suicide?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great example of what, one of the things that I like to talk about a lot is moral panic. panics. Moral panics consume a society with an idea, and then research or ideas that support that idea get reported, and then other research or ideas that don't support it get ignored, and it continues to fuel that idea. So almost every time there's a national crisis, be it 9/11, be it the Great Recession, Great Depression, World War II, there is always going to be a group of people who will prognosticate a mental health tsunami, a raging case of suicide. Suicides are going to triple or, you know, go up by 80%. And you can find these throughout the literature, throughout the 20th century and the 21st century. And yet, if we were that good at predicting suicide rates, then one of my core theses on suicide risk assessment, which is assess the risk factors, don't try and predict the risk, it just wouldn't be true. We're just not that good. So what we've been seeing this year is a very predictable phenomenon called the come together effect. Typically, when we are all pulling together in a common cause, after a flood or hurricane, there's wartime, there's Christmas season, and people are celebrating, or any national holiday, suicide rates come down. Suicide rates don't go up during those times, they come down. And back earlier on, when people were prognosticating a rash of suicides during the lockdown period, it was actually scientifically pretty unlikely. It was either going to be average or lower. Now, the big challenge right now in getting real-time data is that typically suicide investigations and cause of death determinations take time. You have to interview people and you have to find out what's there. You know, this is stuff that doesn't happen right away. And so typically suicide releases, for example, the CDC releases suicide data 2 years lagged. So I get 2018 data in 2020. So to get real-time suicide reporting is rare. In the jurisdictions in which it's been done, my jurisdiction here in BC just released a report. Massachusetts released a report. Japan has released monthly reports. Anywhere it's been studied, it's been without question, it's either been no effect on suicide rates or a slight decrease. So in my jurisdiction, there was a slight decrease. Suicides are down 7% in 2020. Now there's a lot of yearly variation, so I don't know if that means anything. In Massachusetts, there was virtually no change no matter how you slice the data. And in Japan, significantly lower, actually record lows in April and May. They did have a significant increase in August, but again, relative to low numbers. And there is a new signal to be concerned of, which is female rates of suicide in Japan, which are already high, are increasing in August. So, you know, as we get real-time data, what we can basically say is it doesn't look like it had a major effect. And during times of lockdown, there's probably a slightly lower effect on suicide risk.
Now, can I speak anecdotally here? Which is with my population of patients, which I have quite a few outpatients, and they tend to be working class and middle class. During the lockdown, they were actually, and these are people who are already in treatment, obviously, so it's not the general population. They were already seeing a psychiatrist. Most of them are already on medications. Most of them during the lockdown period, and again, Massachusetts, it was pretty scary here. So the lockdown, people took it pretty seriously back in March and April and May. They were actually settled down. People who were depressed, who were used to putting on a happy face and doing all the stuff and taking their kids everywhere and having to be scheduled everywhere, all of a sudden they were kind of taken off the hamster wheel. In addition, a lot of people with obsessions and anxieties are worried about their family members. And, you know, not including the healthcare workers, which is sort of a separate segment here, but most people, they were seeing their family all the time. They were staying with them. They knew they were safe. They knew they were comfortable. So among my patients, they actually did better during the lockdown.
Same with kids. Yeah.
And I think kids, it's maybe misery loves company.
In kids, there's two pockets of population where we saw actually a lot more concern. And generally, I saw the same things that Emily was talking about. So my general patient population did a little bit better. Patients with eating disorders seem to really struggle during the pandemic. I think the lack of ability to do exercise, the likely increased eating by being at home and lack of movement. Mm-hmm. And I think typically people with anorexia have a little bit more of the obsessive style of thinking. And so the disruption to routine was really challenging. And parents of children with neurodiversity really struggled during the pandemic because instantly routines were disrupted. So there are definitely pockets mm-hmm. of population where we saw increased distress, but by and large, our average child with depression or anxiety, there's a gamut, of course, but by and large, they trucked along, and some actually reported that they actually really liked not having to go to school, mm-hmm. not surprisingly.
Substance yeah. abuse and eating disorders in my population mm-hmm. definitely got worse.
So maybe it's because there was a few very public, very sort of advertised, or again, very public suicides among, I think, healthcare workers. You know, there was a couple emergency room physicians that were written about as like big stories on social media and the New York Times. So I think maybe that's, do you think that that is why there's the biggest, kind of this misperception that there is an increased rate?
I have a more cynical view that the reason we hear so much about it is that it was a talking point for politicians who didn't want to do a lockdown. That's my suspicion is why this has come forward.
There was a very famous California emergency doctor who came out and said, we're seeing 200% more suicide attempts this month. In fact, we've had more suicide attempts than we have in an entire year previous. And that got national airplay. It was on Fox News and CNN and everywhere. It was international news. The retraction by the county from which that doctor worked, in which they said, actually, there has only been a couple of suicide attempts, got zero airplay. Literally zero airplay. And it was very hard to find the actual data. There was a very famous public discussion about a physician who died by suicide, which obviously is wrought with challenge because someone's life really matters and there's no question there's other things. But I would say one really important fact of suicidology that I really want people to know is our brains make a very common mistake called recency bias. When someone dies of suicide, often people will try and imagine what was the last thing they did as if the last thing they did was the cause of their suicide. Mm-hmm. And there are hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers exposed to COVID. I don't know what the suicide rate is during that, but the great majority of them don't die by suicide. And our brains quickly go to that last thing that happened, that's the reason they died. And suicide is much more complex than that. Suicide right. is a whole bunch of factors playing together.
I mean, I will say, as we know from the recent JAMA article, that there is a 20% excess death in the United States since March, March through the end of July. And again, I'm in Massachusetts where we had a lot of COVID deaths, a lot of our nursing home deaths. A lot of my patients have had family members who had died, and many of them weren't directly from COVID, but you know, I heard about a 92-year-old aunt who cut herself and didn't want to go to the doctor because they didn't want to go to the emergency room because they didn't want to be exposed to COVID. I had, unfortunately, another patient who had died that I think, you know, if I weren't on the telephone with this person and maybe had seen them in person, that I might have seen some of the medical issues that caused this death coming up. And this person had managed to sort of avoid being seen in the doctor in the last 6 months because of the pandemic. And so there's a lot of excess death, I don't think though it's due to the lockdown. I think it's due to the actual virus and the legitimate worries about the virus.
The virus sucks. It kind of sucks.
Yeah, it really does.
And it's real, just FYI.
It's real.
Yeah.
It's real.
Yeah.
So political scientist and previous guest of the show, Miranda Yaver, actually had a question to follow up on that for you guys. And I'd like to see if either or both of you have thoughts on this. So what about suicidal ideation? Has suicidal ideation gone up during this time, or is it too hard to know that sort of information?
Well, just really briefly, we study suicidal ideation generally by surveying people. Surveys have benefits in that you can get a whole bunch of people, and they have downsides is it's very hard to know what they meant when they checked the box. Usually the survey question is something like, have you seriously considered suicide in the last 30 days? I'll give you two examples, one that's obviously something that we're probably thinking of and one that isn't. One would be like, I was thinking of dying by suicide. That would be an obvious checkbox. The other would be, I heard about someone dying by suicide and I seriously considered what it might be like to be in their situation. And that person might check that box as well. So surveys are challenging to understand what the context of it is. And there is no question, if you design a survey, and there's been lots of scientists who have published lots of articles, the amount of articles being published in 2020 about COVID is really, really high, and it's an easy way to get published. And your methodology is, we're going to do a survey about distress during a very distressing time. You are going to find increased numbers on survey responses.
And can anxiety I just say that it's normal to be distressed during a distressing time? That's not pathological.
Exactly.
This is like the basics of psychiatry here.
By definition, accurate. Yeah.
If you designed a survey and you administered it to people, and then you said, you know what, there's a whole bunch of people at a funeral here. Let's put our depression survey at this funeral. you would unquestionably determine that going to a funeral was associated with an increase in depressive symptoms. But none of those people may meet criteria for depression, the clinical construct. And that's the biggest problem with most of these studies, is they're identifying a signal. But what it actually means in the context of a pandemic that's killing, at this point, 220,000 Americans, almost, I think it's at 1 million worldwide. This is a really hard thing to interpret. It's a distressing time. So I right. totally agree. It's not pathological to be right. stressed.
And Emily, you mentioned at the beginning when we were talking about the two effects of COVID, right? One is maybe long-term mental illness, brain fog, and you know, maybe issues related to encephalitis. And now we're talking about the other consequences of just the stress, being at home, you know, not having our routine, not being able to do the things we love, you know, whether it's eating or drinking too much or hiking or whatever it is, you know, now at least the outdoor exercise and activity is being encouraged once again, which is really, I think that was a huge problem back in March and April. And do you guys think that we have enough infrastructure in place at this time to support the mental health issues that's going on or I think the question is probably twofold. A, do we have infrastructure enough at all? And B, do we have infrastructure enough with what's been going on the last 6 months?
You know, I have to say, again, in Massachusetts, and we might have more resources than a lot of states, certainly, they have moved a ton to telehealth. And some of this has been actually very spectacular. You know, a lot of my patients, I'm trying to get them into a partial program where they have to drive there every day. You know, they're worried about they don't have a car, they don't have a ride, where are they going to park? And now it's online. So they can just show up at 9 a.m. My no-show rates in my clinic, like you're saying, are almost zero. Because if they don't show up in my online waiting room, I can just call them and they're home. If I have an emergency, I can just, you know, and call them back and make an appointment right there and actually get paid for it, which I never did before, which is nice. And I don't have to worry about a relative being able to drive them or anything like that. So in some respects, it's actually opened up, you know, we have partials all over the state and my patients are able to go to any one of a large hospital conglomeration, you know, without having to drive 2 hours to get there. And, you know, in general, the inpatient censuses have been down. So people have been able to get in there faster. So that's actually been great. And I wish we didn't have the pandemic to cause that.
Right. I do think nationwide, I think Medicare is reimbursing telehealth now. And they, to their credit, nobody really gives insurance credit, but it happened incredibly quickly. So I think it's across the country now that you can get reimbursed for video and telephone.
Our insurance companies aren't charging copays for telehealth. So if I have someone who is in crisis, I can see them every single day and not have to worry about them coming back and paying, you know, $20 to $45 per appointment and getting worried about that. And I can actually keep them out of the hospital because I'm seeing them every single day.
That's amazing.
I've never been able to do that before. It's actually quite incredible.
I'm trying Tyler, to make Canadian faces here. one of the more striking and disappointing things whenever crises like this hit is just knowing that insurance is such a problem in America. I can say this from the Canadian perspective, like I'm so glad to hear that insurance companies did this, but even the concept of a patient worrying about seeing a doctor because they might get charged a copay is bizarre to my Canadian ears. And it really does. It's anathema to good mental health care. What we know about mental health concerns is that if you're economically disadvantaged, you have a mental health concern, there are really, really severe outcomes. And the inability to pay for that or that have copays and stuff like that, it's bizarre. I know there's things. I would say Canada's, we have a strong social safety net. As you know, our taxes are higher. We have universal health care. We had a very robust employment benefit for people who needed to not work because of COVID. And so from that point, the structure was there. But prior to the pandemic, this is not because of policies of the pandemic. Prior to the pandemic, structurally supporting significant mental illness, really, really going to the primary drivers of mental illness, things like socioeconomic status, things like trauma, child abuse, all the things that are at the root of some of our challenges are tragically underfunded. And if it's so in Canada, it must be so in America. So,
yeah.
Well, you know, I sense you judging us. And
We
are in it.
It's polite, and I'll apologize for it.
Very Canadian judgment. It's very polite Canadian judgment. And we've definitely earned it. Let me ask you guys a question. As a parent, there's a lot of fear, a lot of concern about the long-term effects that this situation that lockdowns and the pandemic are going to have on kids. Is there any precedent or any data from the past, did anyone ever study the kids from the Spanish flu era? Like, how do we think the kids are faring and how do we think they will fare?
I mean, this is an interesting question because you would routinely see, and actually my mother was infected with one of the, I think it was the 1952 flu. And when she was young, and she missed an entire semester of school because she was so ill. When people would routinely get things like strep throat, causing heart issues, and would be out of school for a while. And we just don't have that so much anymore. Occasionally, the rare kid, you know, might get cancer or something like that and be out. But for the most part, you know, you have a fever, you have antibiotics, and we just don't have that anymore. It's actually normal in the human condition for kids to die and for kids to spend, you know, months out of school. And, you know, we always coped. I mean, with polio, schools were closed for long periods of time. Even back with H1N1 in 2009, mm-hmm. They actually had over 1,000 schools closed for a period of time in the United States. And it just wasn't big news at the time. I'm a mother. I have two kids. They're 11 and 13. They're in hybrid school right now. I'm very glad they enjoy going back to school. It seems very safe. It's a very small number of kids. They're all wearing masks. They have mask breaks outside where they're, you know, 10 feet apart at least. So it's good for them to see their friends. But to be honest, they've been online with their friends for 7 months, like pretty much 24/7 now. And they're really enjoying it was like a long summer for them. They're fine. You know, they don't, you know, I certainly talk to parents whose kids with ADHD and neurodiversity who have a terrible time with the online schooling, but, and I think it's really important for schools to be very flexible and to allow those kids back, you know, the 4 days, you know, as much as possible. But you know, it also was extremely, extremely difficult for my parents, who had two working parents at home with very young children. A nightmare, an absolute nightmare. They were the people, besides the healthcare workers, they were the people who were tearing their hair out during the early lockdown before the daycares opened.
Yeah.
But, you know, honestly, my kids and a lot of kids will be, they're fine. There's also, though, some data that kids are falling behind. And if you fall behind by the third grade, you know, it's really hard to catch up. And there was some like 65% decrease in reading. I was talking to a teacher about that. And their reading scores, some scary stuff. But I don't know. I I tend to, you know, I'm a psychiatrist. I'm like, let's look at the big picture here. Are they safe? Are they eating? Are they healthy? Did they not kill their grandparents with COVID? That's a win. So let's go forward.
Yeah.
And see how we're doing.
Yeah.
It's and from my point of view, I would just, you know, I'm not a parent myself, but obviously I, as a child medicine psychiatrist, I work with many parents. I think, you know, there's a big reason for parents to be always worried, because parents have a laser eye focused on the future. Parents, you know, if a child gets drunk one night, all of a sudden the parent is imagining their child homeless on the street with an addictions problem. And that's what drives a lot of that kind of future fear challenge. But kids are a little bit more short-term thinking. Kids have an ability to ride with changes, even when they're not healthy changes, even when things aren't going well. I grew up in a very broken home, and for me, it was not abnormal to have mom and dad not talking. And it didn't, it looked strange to me to see mom and dad talking. Now, I'm not saying it's great that mom and dad don't talk, but I trucked along. My day was kind of my day. Kids have an ability to look a little bit more short-term in the future. They will remember this time. It will be the weird time where they weren't allowed to, you know, be in contact with their friends. But I would just really like to put a voucher that our kids are really awesome. They are so socially connected. Their attention spans are amazing. This idea that kids' attention spans are awful because of Twitter or because of Twitch or whatever else, just not true. Yeah. Attention spans are through the roof in terms of kids. They're social. I talked to 13-year-olds about saving the environment and about Black Lives Matter, and this is stuff that is because of the social connectedness of kids. Our the generation that's replacing us is a really good generation to replace us. Let me just put it that way.
Oh, right, that's nice and positive.
Kids are all right.
They are. And there's resilience, and we know that about kids, you know.
They don't care about masks. Yeah. You see sort of these hysterical outbreaks on Twitter among adults about, oh my God, we're sending kids to school with masks. Oh my God. And they don't care.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, I'm going to wear my mask. Oh, can I have a cloth one?
Some of the dynamics in the school are really funny, because the little kids who are a little bit more on the tattletale side, they'll be like, teacher, so-and-so took his mask off. And so like the mask dynamic is now like a playing out in schools. It's really quite interesting.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I like them ratting out each other.
Right. I love narcs at school.
Yeah.
I love also the, you know, kids, it's like a mask. It's Halloween all year round.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. We appreciate the optimism, Tyler. And we'll close out. And we just want to hear from both of you. Maybe Emily, you can start. You know, we're talking about everyone else. How are you guys? Are you guys caring for your own mental health? Is this like a personal struggle to get through this as a psychiatrist?
I would say that the level of distress is challenging. I'm adding more emergency patients. I'm not actually seeing any new patients, but I have a ton of my ex-patients coming back. I miss walking up and down with my patients, seeing if they're limping, see if they've buttoned all their buttons, seeing if they smell like gin or if they smell like nicotine. All that's really important that I don't see now, but I also see, you know, I had a patient show me their pet lizard, which they wouldn't have brought, right. You know, and I get to see them at home where they're in many cases a lot more comfortable than they are in the office. And that's a really invaluable information for psychiatrists. So
what are you doing for you? Like, what's your thing? Is it Peloton? Is it Twitch?
I mean, it is Peloton, actually.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, sorry. Right. Hey, that's cool. I'm on Peloton, too.
Hey, Peloton, give us money.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, totally. Peloton, if you're listening, you're the one sponsor we'll take.
Yeah.
I love Peloton. I'm on a 120-week streak, actually.
Wow. Strong.
You know, I try to do like a real ride about 3 to 4 times a week. And then I do sort of like, I listen to a podcast and do like a just ride on other days.
Yeah.
I'm really trying to kind of at least make sure that my sleep's okay.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I'm doing. I need to nail down like really getting in, you know, making sure that I'm eating really clean and doing things like that would be better. But it's like pie every day.
You got to reduce the brain fog. You got to take care of your gut microbiome. Tyler, what are you doing for your own personal mental health?
I didn't realize how much I was carrying. I'm an inpatient emergency psychiatrist. So, you know, I was not someone who could be at home. So at the beginning phase of the pandemic, all of my colleagues went home to do telehealth. And I was in the hospital, and this is before we knew anything that was going to happen. Now, the hospital I work at, we've had, or it's a children's hospital, we've had one or maybe two, maybe three cases of COVID. So it ended up being okay. But the first few weeks, I worked 14 days in a row because no one else, it was hard to find people to come in. You know, I'm still seeing the same sick kids who really need help, or the crises that are just unavoidably inpatient crises. Everyone else who stayed home went home. And then I came home, and there was, I don't know if you guys had this everywhere, but in my city at around 7 p.m., there was this applause that went for healthcare heroes. Mm-hmm. And it was like this just moment where you'd open the doors and you'd hear it. And I came home one day, and it was like maybe day 13 or 14, and I heard this applause, and I literally just tears started streaming out of my face. I didn't realize what I was carrying. I was working because it had to be done, but I was actually carrying a lot of fear and burden, and you know, I love things like travel and photography, which I, you know, it's very hard to do when I can't go anywhere and see new things. So I got into some astrophotography, which is cool because there's been a lot more clear skies. There's a lot less people about. And every day since about 3 years ago, I've been shooting 300 three-pointers.
Wow.
It's my thing. Mm-hmm. I shoot three-pointers every morning. It's my moment of zen. And it really did help me. I noticed when I was having this moment, I haven't played basketball in like 3 weeks. And of course, because there was nobody playing basketball. And then my shooting was really important to me. It was part, one of my rhythms. So I think once I started to get back into my rhythms and started doing self-care, taking time off instead of working nonstop, things got a lot better.
Well, you guys, we really appreciate everything that you've done and everything you continue to do. Where can people find you? Tell us where people can read more of your stuff or follow you.
Yeah, so probably the fastest way to find me is Twitter at Evolutionary Psy. And then there's a link in my Twitter bio to the Psychology Today blog that I have, Evolutionary Psychiatry, which is about food and mood and biologic underpinnings of mental illness and alternative medicine and you know, light, how that affects the brain and mood and mental illness. So I'm at Evolutionary Psychiatry at Psychology Today.
I'm at TylerBlack32 on Twitter. I picked 32. I wasn't last. I was very first. But Magic Johnson is one of my favorite players on the Los Angeles Lakers. I didn't know that shorter was better because he gave me two more characters. Dr.TylerBlack@gmail.com. I love getting random emails from people who've heard me speak about different things and ask me topics. I can't promise a response, but I do like hearing from people who wanted to engage.
And I'll attest to both you guys being great people to follow, great sources of information, really fun. And I follow you guys very attentively. So, hey, thanks again. Thank you guys so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. It's been fun.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Virtual high five. Cool.
Virtual high five.
High five. High five. Sunny San Diego, and I'm so embarrassed I did San Diego. I'm gonna cut that. I don't know. That's probably a good point, but
no,
it sounded
know.
Much better.
No,
sounded much
you
better.
Don't know.
Okay, no, you settle down now. So I have a question. I have a question. Said, don't you yell at me? Don't you yell at me in front of the guests?
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive.